O'Reilly Digital Media explores the future of audio, video, and photography. Each show brings you insights from leading experts. Learn more by visiting digitalmedia.oreilly.com.
I'm Derek Story, the digital media evangelist with O'Reilly Media. It feels weird saying media twice in the same thing. And I'm here with Deke McClellan, my favorite Photoshop author, the guy that if you really want to learn the stuff inside and out, if you want to be a smart Photoshop user, you'll take a look at his book. And speaking of smart, Deke.
What a segue.
I just create my own segues here. Thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I want to talk about smart objects today. And the reason why, first of all, I know you're passionate about them in both pro and you have a few, you know, questions about them. But also because I don't think a lot of people are maybe using smart objects as much as they could. I think it's kind of one of those new features that everyone hasn't become comfortable yet. So take it from the bottom floor and talk about a little bit why we should be using smart objects and what the heck they are.
All right, so for starters, smart objects are essentially embedded image files. They don't have to be images, they can be illustrations, but they're embedded images inside of a larger composition. So as soon as you turn something, and just bear with me, because at first it's like, well, what the heck are you talking about? But once you turn an image into a smart object, you no longer have immediate access to its pixels. So that's what you lose. So all that sort of mid-range of brushes and edit tools, dodge and burn and all that stuff, the heel brush, you lose access to those tools directly. You can still heal an image, but you have to dig into it in order to get access. The big trade-off is, in return for the fact that you no longer get pixel-level access, instead you get all this non-destructive functionality. So, for example, in CS2, with smart objects, you could perform non-destructive transformations. So you can scale the image like to 150%, then you can scale down to 75%, then you can scale to 40%, whatever you want to do. And it all concatenates, meaning it all boils down to one scale operation instead of continually destroying the pixels. And same with rotations and so on. So anytime you're thinking of transforming a layer inside Photoshop, it's definitely a good idea to first convert it to a smart object, then apply your transformation, because that way you can always bring the original stuff back, especially if you're scaling it down. Because you could scale something down to like 10%, and then you can scale it back up, and you still are working from those original pixels, so you can still gain access to them. Also, you can replicate a layer several times. And that way, if you're using a repeating object, this doesn't happen that much inside Photoshop, but for some illustrators it does. You can repeat an object a few times throughout a single image, repeat a layer. And then if you decide you want to update all of those objects, all those elements in kind, then you just have to update one smart object and bang, you're done.
Well, anyway. I want to ask you a question about it. So, let's say on my hard drive,
right,
I have a PSD file.
Okay.
And I open it up and I create a smart object to do some of this work. What ends up, does another file end up on my hard drive? Is it stored within the Photoshop file? Where does that smart object live?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because I'll just elaborate a little more on the question and then I'll tell you the answer. Like, for example, you can take an Illustrator file, right? Mm-hmm. And you can import it into Photoshop as it's a .ai file, so it's a vector file. It's got all this stuff going on. And then Photoshop isn't necessarily going to recognize the vector. It's not going to seem to, because it's a big, complicated vector file. So, like, it's a logo. And so you scale the logo into place, and then you can still scale it up, scale it down. You want to change the color, let's say, of the logo. You double-click on it. It opens up in Illustrator. Change that color. Close it. Saves back into Photoshop, and you've updated the colors. So,
right.
So that implies that there's some kind of link between Photoshop and that Illustrator file, for example, and that's not true. So it's not a linking experience at all. It's an embedding experience.
Oh,
so meaning that the Illustrator file gets embedded into the larger composition. Your image, if you take an image layer and convert it into a smart object, that becomes an embedded image file.
Interesting.
And so everything's embedded inside that one composition. Now, there are a few weird caveats, but for example, another really great use, right, is you place a camera raw object, a camera raw file.
Now we're talking. talking my territory.
Exactly.
Yes, here
right.
We go. Ears perking.
And so you've got that camera raw image inside your Photoshop, your larger Photoshop composition.
Right.
If you want to still gain access, if you don't like the colors, you know, you start messing around with the larger composition, and that changes your perception of the colors inside the camera raw layer, and mm-hmm. you decide you want to change it, then instead of applying levels or curves or, God forbid, hue saturation or something like that, you just double click on that camera raw layer inside the layers palette, and bang, you're back inside camera raw.
Oh.
You can make the modifications you want to. You still working from your high bit depth image, and then you boil it back into Photoshop, and there it is. And so again, it's a wildly non-destructive modification.
Of all the things you do with smart objects, what's like the favorite Deke McClellan smart object that where you go, God, I'm glad I have this?
Well, okay, so the thing that I was really turned on by initially. And I have to say, I was really turned on by it initially. Then I was like, huh, this isn't really as great as I hoped it would be. And now I'm thinking, yeah, it actually is. You just have to go through a little bit of additional
pain.
There's
a lot of things in life like that.
Yeah, exactly. CS3 introduced smart filters. And so you take a smart object, and as soon as you have a smart object established, then you can go ahead and apply non-destructive filters. So mm-hmm. all of your sharpening filters, all of your smoothing filters, your effects filters if you want to go that route. Basically everything that's an authentic filter inside the software except lens blur, which currently they don't have worked out.
Right.
And then a couple of color adjustment functions, variations, and shadow highlight. And The great thing about it initially, of course, is that you now have non-destructive filters. You can change your settings. You can change the blend modes that are associated with them. You can continue to tweak your sharpening settings, for example, to accommodate other modifications that you make. So you're never really making these big destructive modifications.
That's
early
nice.
On
right.
in the process. So it all seems really great. The bad piece is, I have to say, in a perfect world, non-destructive filters would be handled just like adjustment layers, right? You would have this layer of filtering that you could apply just on top, the way you do inside After Effects, frankly. And you wouldn't have to go through all these sort of the weird black arts that you have to engage in where smart objects are concerned. But so Adobe's defense has long been, well, it's all very well and good for After Effects to do that because you're working with relatively small frames, even though they continue to get bigger and bigger.
Mm.
But Photoshop is working with these huge, whopping big files, and we're just not going to be able to handle that kind of stuff because unlike, I don't know if this makes any sense, but unlike an adjustment layer, which is just drilling down a single column of pixels
right.
in order to make its modification, filters are actually analyzing neighboring pixels, and so it becomes extremely complicated. It becomes sort of this 3D modification that really starts dragging down the program computationally. So anyway, problem is that you have things like each single one of the filters that you apply has to share to one smart object has to share a single mask. So
if you
can apply three or four filters to a single smart object layer, but they're all going to have to be masked similarly.
Right.
And if you want to diverge from that, what the heck do you do? And so the technique that I've come up with that's actually worked out really, really well, and this is what I was showing in my session this morning, is nesting a smart object inside of a smart object. So basically you say, okay, this group of... Basically what I had was this photograph that I shot of this kind of mangy bison.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got some problems where the bison is concerned, of course, that we want to modify. But it's also got these horizontal striation patterns that are a function of the camera I used to shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's got some wandering colors that are just a function of whatever the heck. It's got like these burgundy patches next to some brown patches. So in other words, we not only want to sharpen the image to bring out the clarity of all the surface detail like the hair and so on, but we also want to average away some of the color problems.
Right.
We want to reduce some of the noise in the image and so on. So I had basically a sharpening converted to a smart object. I've got a sharpening effect and a median effect that are both applied to this one layer. And typically when you're working this way, you want to smooth and then sharpen. Mm-hmm. You want to work in that order. But the great thing here is you can sharpen first, bring out all the problems. You can really start seeing the problems once you sharpen mm-hmm. it, right? And then you can say, okay, I need to do a median pass. Do it afterwards and just move it underneath. So you can change the order of your filters.
That's nice. That's nice.
And then I had the background, though, that was starting to also get, the colors were getting medianed away, but I wanted to keep the background. There's nothing really wrong with it. So I mask, basically I do a quick mask, adjust the bison, leave the background alone. But then I still have this horizontal striations that are going through the image, and that's going through the entire image, background and foreground. So somehow I need to apply the reduced noise filter, which took care of this problem, sort of, mostly. And I want to be able to apply it to the entire bison image. So then that's where you do a nested smart object, and the idea is you've already got a smart object, you double-click on it to open it up, you turn that thing that's inside that embedded image, you turn it into a smart object. So now you've got two embedded images, right? One embedded inside of itself. And then you go ahead and throw some smart filters on top of it,
right.
Go back out, and they're all sort of more or less concatenating on top of each other.
Now, how much... I mean, is this making a big file? Is this something that's like beginning to take over your hard drive, or is it mainly XML type data? What kind of thing is going on underneath the hood here?
Well, you know, this is what's really truly amazing about it, 'cause old school, right? If you were wanting to keep things as non-destructive as possible, right? You would take the image, you would jump it to a new layer. So you leave your original image unmodified.
Right.
Jump it to a new layer, apply your sharpening or whatever effects. And like a really typical workflow was, let's say you decide to sharpen with high pass. You would do a high pass layer, apply the overlay blend mode to it, and you know maybe modify the opacity a little bit. And you've got these two layers that are working together. Problem there is you now have two, let's say you're working with an 8-bit image. You've now got two 8-bit layers on top of each other, so the size of your image is effectively doubled,
right,
for what is really not a layered composition. I mean, there's not a ton of, you know, you're not doing all kinds of
right.
little
you're paying
bits
a
and
high
pieces
price
here
for that correction, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that takes up more room in memory, and it takes more room on your hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about working with a smart object is you do that same high pass thing, except you're doing it non-destructively, applying it to that smart object layer.
Mm-hmm.
So you do high pass, you give it an overlay, whatever percent, you know, you decide to change it to, and whatever size it was flat, it's exactly that size, that layered. So you haven't added anything. You've added a few K of instructions, and it's sort of the equivalent of metadata or XMP instructions.
Right.
It's not a separate file that you can get access to, but anyway. But it is just, it's just some additional stuff. And even once I started like doing, you know, once you start doing a mask, that's another third again as much information that you have to throw in there. And then, you know, you start doing the embedded thing.
Right.
Anyway, I had four filters, a mask, and all these settings that were being applied, and I had a 15 meg file, so it wasn't that big in the first place. 15 meg file grew to a 20 meg file after I'm done.
That's not bad at all, because that could easily be a 60, 80 meg file.
That's exactly right.
Doing the other system. So that alone is a good argument for kind of getting your head around smart objects.
So my only one caveat, because everything about smart objects, I swear to you, has a caveat. The only
right.
caveat would be that instead of you wasting a bunch of space in your hard drive and in memory, there's two things. It does take some effort to wrap your mind around what you're doing. So
right.
there's some internal computational stuff
exactly.
going on. And then also, it's not necessarily fast. The way
yeah.
things are organized right now, once your files start getting large, you have to be patient and
yeah.
you have to suffer through an occasional, you know, sort of wait cycle. But one of the biggest tips there, I have to say, because like if I don't, you know, we all work with before and afters, right? You turn an eyeball off, you
yeah,
turn the eyeball back
exactly.
on, just get a sense of what you've done, right?
Right?
So when you turn an eyeball off for like you've got a smart object and then you've got a series of filters, and you turn an eyeball off, you would expect it's just kind of like a cached thing, right?
Right, exactly.
It's just an undo, it's a redo, that kind of thing. You turn that eyeball off, that's tracked in history because you just got rid of the computation. You turn it back on, it has to recompute, it shows up in history again. So the workaround, the way to do your before and afters is to open up that history palette and just go back and forth,
right.
and then it's bang, bang, you know, because anything in history happens immediately.
Nice. That's a great tip, actually. Hey, well, thanks for coming by.
Yeah, my pleasure. I hope any of that made sense, just hearing it, you know, without showing it, but so theoretical. But you
well,
know.
No, I was visualizing it all in my head.
You were? That's good.
You probably need to get a new camera, too. I just, you know, that banding thing, you know. You got.
Well, you know what it is? It's a Leica. It's a Leica.
No,
it's a
no,
DLX3, no. So it's not a bad camera.
Oh, man.
But it's just, it is a point and shoot ultimately, right. But it's a good camera. You know how it is. Sometimes you'll get, if you don't just have the lighting right, or you know, you're not, my problem, Derek, I could learn so much from you. My problem is I am ultimately very lazy behind the camera.
Yes.
And especially, okay, so Buffalo Day, when I shot those bison, we were in South Dakota, we were surrounded by these bison. And not only was I just doing point and shoot out the window, they were really close, so I had some great shots.
Right.
But I was, my card was almost full. And that's all I had. I only had four images I could shoot, and otherwise I'm sitting there deleting images and trying to take more pictures and deleting images. Yeah, it was fairly hellish.
Well, we'll talk afterwards.
Yeah. Right. Get a lot of pointers.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a great show. It's great to have you here.
All right. Thank you, Derek.
This show was produced and is copyrighted by O'Reilly Media. For more podcasts, tutorials, reviews, weblogs, tips, and tricks, visit O'Reilly Digital Media at digitalmedia.oreilly.com.